are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, January 17th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Thursday. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Libby Watson, writer for Splinter. We're talking about Brexit, the failed no-confidence vote, the failed May government. What comes next? Plus, why can't the New York Times just call Steve King a racist? And why the language of racially tinged points to a bigger media problem in the era of overt GOP white supremacy? Plus, Raj Shah's new lobbying gig in Amazon. We'll get to that. Nancy Pelosi continuing to show that she does know how to handle Donald Trump. She wants his State of the Union to be rescheduled because of the government shutdown. Not fair. And another thing not fair, Donald Trump's fast food summit didn't make much of a dent, apparently. His approval ratings are actually starting to slide with his base. We always wondered what would have finally make that happen.
We're going to need more burgers.
Civilians and U.S. troops were killed in a suicide bombing, which ISIS has claimed responsibility for in northern Syria. HUD official departs over a disagreement over the grotesque mishandling of Puerto Rico. Rudy Giuliani says Trump didn't collude with Russia, but can't say if campaign aides did or didn't. Authoritarian Turkey under authoritarian Erdogan seeks arrest for Enes Kanter. He's a New York Knicks center. They won an Interpol red notice on him in a horrifying abuse of really everything. AOC is going to teach other people in the House how to use Twitter, but is that really the point? She also used a drinking game analogy, we're going to call it, to explain how she's going to work the progressive agenda, and we like it.
You played quarters?
Yeah. What does that have to do with anything? Purdue, the Sheldon Whitehouse response, Purdue cemented ties with universities and hospitals to expand opioid sales, and Representative Sheila Jackson Lee might have sought retribution against a 19-year-old intern who tried to expose, who was raped by a coordinator for the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation in a really, really obscene, grotesque story, which, if true, should certainly end Sheila Jackson Lee's career. Ed Case, he's a new WAC congressman from Hawaii, and also he's apparently an Asian guy trapped in a white body. I guess he's the opposite of the other pejorative, banana, which I've heard, apparently. Two GOP congressmen stroll through the halls of Congress with a Holocaust-denying troll on the same day that everybody's coming together to condemn Steve King. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Three of us here. Jamie is writing away. Sam's probably, I don't know, dealing with kid stuff and watching videos about his interactions with Dave Rubin.
He's seen your videos. We're definitely good. I know a lot of people want to make sure that
we have seen all of the Dave Rubin videos.
They're wonderful. I mean,
they're amazing. They're awesome.
It's everything we can do to not play them today.
Yes, and so we need to save them for Sam because
they're embargoed.
Things like that. Exactly. They're embargoed, and we also just want those videos probably expand the actuarial table on Sam's life. So we want
The vitality that enters him.
Yes. Sometimes he's sitting here and he's just like, God damn it. And I have to do that. God damn it. What? And then we're like, Sam, look. Somebody did it. It's a trap house beat, but it's Curb Your Enthusiasm. What's trap house? Is that like...
Is that the Chapo guys?
Is that the Chapo? Is that like... I remember, one time I met Run DMC. And it was with Sarah Silverman, and it was 1997. Oh my God, Jesus Christ, please shut up. Just watch the video. And then we play the video, and then his whole body, he just gets a giant, big, huge grin on his face. And he's just like, that's pretty funny. That's pretty good. All right, what should I tweet? I'm going to tweet Ruben. I'm going to tweet him. What should I tweet? I think I'm going to say... And then we game out a tweet. So all of that's happening tomorrow. That was very funny. Wow. But look, all I can say is Dummy Dave, folks. Dummy Dave.
He's shook.
He's a shook dummy. It's like...
Shook dumbs.
Shook dumb. Steve Crowder's pretty goddamn shook, too.
He's laying low.
He is really laying low. His whole little, like, I bother college students with nonsense hustles getting really disrupted by the fact that he's too much of a coward to debate Sam. You know, I'll say I'm not as into debates as Sam, but I will say I debated that friggin' Carl Sargon guy. And he didn't seem... That guy apparently will... I mean, he seems to be debate... You know, he'll debate... Anybody, right?
Oh, yeah.
So that's going to have to be a credit where credit's due type of thing. Like, all of these guys are out here biting all that rhetoric about open exchange, but then two of the prime peddlers of it, Crowder and Rubin, can't even sit down. And look, I mean, Charlie Kirk showed up for Sam. Sam didn't... I mean, Sam certainly won the debate if you were watching and you had any semblance of knowledge, but, like, you know... Charlie Kirk left in a metaphorical body bag, but he didn't even know he left in a metaphorical body bag.
He earned that paycheck, at least.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it does make, as much as I don't really like debate that much, and I don't really care to give people respect for things that should be obvious, but nonetheless, it makes you say, like, all right, I put Charlie Kirk in a different category than Crowder.
You know who the question's about now, though, is Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, no, the question is about Ben Shapiro, because the real question is, can you spend 5 minutes not bizarrely obsessing over Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Twitter and engage in a debate with Sam Seder?
We are going to obsess about Ben Shapiro the way he obsesses about AOC, because we want to get into those replies, too. I like it's one thing to flood Dave and Steve's replies.
Bolsonaro. I don't really know much about that. I loved how he was like, oh, man, what a moron. Let's talk about the opposite of those guys. Somebody who's awesome, somebody who is great, and we all love. And it's true. It's really true. Super producer Matt and I... always can keep up with each other on Instagram because we can see which pictures we're liking of this particular pop star. Cardi B finally intervened. By the way, I just want to remind everybody, has praised Bernie Sanders, Eleanor Roosevelt, the New Deal, backed Cynthia Nixon and Jumaane Williams over the Cuomo ticket. She's on point, and she's finally intervened in the government shutdown. This was on Instagram yesterday. Let's let Cardi B lay it out.
Hey, y'all. I just want to remind y'all, because it's been a little bit over 3 weeks, okay? Trump is now ordering, as in summoning, federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid. Now, I don't want to hear y'all motherfuckers talking about, oh, but Obama shut down the government for 17 days. Yeah, bitch. For health care, so your grandma could check her blood pressure, and you bitches could go check your pussy in the gynecologist with no motherfucking problem. Now,
Boss,
I know a lot of y'all...
I'm sorry, I forgot that part. I was going to say, I shouldn't do a warning on this, because I'm sorry, from my opinion, if you can't deal with a few F words, you know, I don't know what to tell you, but I guess I should have given, like, all right, you know, if you have kids, you could either have your kids not listen to this, or you can make them super cool at school.
This is a good way to broach these topics.
Yeah, exactly. This is a good, yeah, this is a good way to get them both ahead of their classmates in terms of being cool and knowing pop culture and expanding the vocabulary in a ways that they'll actually get social credit for, as well as a real practical introduction to the issues like the necessity of covering women's full gynecological care. Go ahead.
Your grandma could check her blood pressure and you bitches could go check your pussy in the gynecologist with no motherfucking problem. Now, I know a lot of y'all don't care because y'all don't work for the government or y'all probably don't even have a job, but this shit is really fucking serious, bro. This shit is crazy. Like, our country is in a hellhole right now. All for a fucking war. Like, we really need to take this serious. I feel like we need to take some action. I don't know what type of action, bitch, because this is not what I do, but, bitch, I'm scared. This is crazy, and I really feel bad for these people that got to go to fucking work to not get motherfucking paid.
That's exactly it, 100%. I mean, look, I'm not, you know, you can turn it into a comedy routine or whatever, but the truth of the matter is like, it doesn't require that you use the same vocabulary to make that pretty fucking simple point. I mean,
I'd say that's better communication than Pelosi and Schumer.
It's better than 90%. There's nothing complicated about it. That's it. I mean, look, and basically, I mean, obviously it's different, but there's some formula to, like, that's one of the things that Ocasio-Cortez does, right? She just lays it out. It is crazy. It is demented. It is immoral. I mean, it's...
And scary.
And scary and stupid and mortifying that some demented old trust fund baby demagogue who's never accomplished anything in his life is holding this country captive so he can build a delusional, racist, unnecessary, nonsensical wall on top of a border policy that's already cost children's lives. And now people who work for the federal government, already people who work for the federal government, are going to be forced to work without pay, on top of which this could start affecting people very soon who rely on SNAP benefits and housing, like real people who are already terrorized through the economics of this country. It's scary. It's disgusting. It's stupid. And she's totally right. We'll be right back with Libby Watson on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Libby Watson. She's a writer for Splinter. Libby, how you doing? Thanks for doing this.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I want to talk, and let's use the your accent to maximum advantage and talk about Brexit first. It was a pretty intense last couple of days. Theresa May's Brexit proposal went down by a significant margin. I think it was like, what was it, like 404 to 200 or something like that. I know it's not the exact number, but it was a big loss. And then Jeremy Corbyn's motion of no confidence, which would have dissolved the May government and gotten us into elections, was rejected as well. The Lib Dems, which I guess are, how would you describe liberal Democrats to an American audience? What is that party like? Like, where would they be if they were in the United States, other than also irrelevant?
That's a good question. So basically, that, I mean, they are, I think in American terms, they would still be pretty, pretty left. I mean, they're kind of, similar to the Democrats, but they're kind of what the sort of centrist to conservative side of the Democrats would be if they were a different party. They are also just like completely irrelevant these days. I mean, they haven't been in government. I mean, the Liberal Party was in government in the 1920s, and that's the last time they actually had a prime minister. Then they formed a coalition with the Conservative Party in 2010, and basically just like completely threw out everything that they supposedly stood for, including they campaigned on abolishing tuition fees and then signed off on the Conservatives tripling tuition fees. So that kind of tells you everything you need to know about them.
That does. That definitely tells you everything you need to know about them. And they refused to back Labour's no confidence vote. Their leader, Vince Cable, said, since he appears, he's talking about Corbyn, appears determined to play party political games rather than acting on the wishes of his own members and MPs. And that is very ironic, given what you just... I mean, basically, like, as you said, I think it was Nick Clegg became the deputy prime minister to David Cameron after running a campaign against university tuition fees and to protect social spending after the recession. Yeah, I mean, he signed, and then their bragging was like, oh, well, it was going to be like double worse in the private meetings. So, like, we should get credit for.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they ran to the left to try and get any votes at all, and then went into government with a terrible conservative, austerity, social welfare slashing government. So
and now they're opposing this Corbyn no confidence vote. So I guess, like, I mean, what's your sense of where this goes from here? I guess it's like, okay, so Corbyn wants to go to elections because this government has no, it's done. But the Tories won't. The Tories are still going to keep her there, or maybe replace her with somebody else. But obviously, they don't want to lose power. The Lib Dems, to the extent they have a few votes, are just concerned about remaining in the EU. And then, like, Tony Blair's back on the scene, like, being like, I think we need to have another referendum, blah, blah, blah. So, like, how do all these forces interact together? And how do you think it's going to play out over the next couple of weeks?
I mean, I think the only truthful answer I can give is that I have no idea.
Yeah.
And no one has any idea. But I mean, I think the thing with Corbyn is that, I think if it were, and this isn't to say that I would want it to be another Labour leader because I love Corbyn, but I think if it were a different Labour leader, then the dynamics may be slightly different, because I think the Lib Dems and the Tories are so terrified of a Labour victory, which I think would happen if there were an election. I think they're so terrified of a Labour victory that they won't do what, the only reasonable thing to do is, which is to, to call to support a no confidence motion or call for a general election or whatever. So that being the case, there's no force to push Theresa May out, which is incredible. I mean, her ability to hang on against all odds is really quite astounding. So, I mean, I really don't know, because the problem is that, you know, the EU, I don't see the EU budging or like giving a different deal. At the time that the deal was formed, they said, like, this is the deal. You know, if you don't like it, then goodbye. So, I mean, my fear is that we end up with a no deal Brexit, because they just can't get it together. And it's only, what, 6 weeks or 2 months or something until that happens. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'm going to tell my mum to start, you know, stocking up on bananas and tomatoes, because I think we might end up with a no deal scenario.
And so, I mean, do you think that there's people, I know that like the business community obviously mostly opposed it because of how disruptive it is. But on the other hand, it's like, do you think that, I don't know, I could see a lot of right-wing forces in the UK being like, all right, well, so like, here's the time to just become like, we're just going to try to be like the, you know, Dubai or Singapore off of Europe. We're going to get rid of the NHS, and we're just going to be even like a more pure financial hub with like, you know, closed borders.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I honestly, this whole, ever since the vote, I don't know what the kind of no deal crowd has been thinking. I mean, I think a lot of them, especially, you know, the, not so much the sort of, you know, actual British people that, you know, would be okay with a no deal, but the Tory politicians that have gone in on it, I feel like they're, you know, they did this for politically expedient reasons. You know, Boris Johnson, for example, you know, is a big, like, hard Brexit guy. And, you know, he's not stupid. Like, he knows that a no deal would be terrible or whatever, but he's found it politically advantageous to position himself as a sort of posh version of Nigel Farage. And not that Nigel Farage isn't posh, but, you know, Boris Johnson is, like, the poshest guy in the world. But now,
look these people up if you haven't heard of them. They are really, like, they're every British stereotype imaginable. If you don't know who, you probably know who Boris Johnson is. Some people might not know who Nigel Farage is, but how would you describe Nigel Farage to people?
Oh man, yeah. I mean, you might have seen him if you watch a lot of Fox News.
Yeah.
I'm guessing none of your listeners do.
Probably not.
He was the leader of the UK Independence Party, famous only for pushing for Brexit and for being horribly anti-immigration and anti-Islam. He's a sort of horrible frog-faced posh guy who like wanders around in wellies and drinks a pint and pretends to be all British, but of course has a German wife.
That son of a bitch, are you serious?
Oh yeah,
he has a German wife. That's
yeah.
Like the only way you should be anti-immigrant is not having a German spouse.
In Britain for sure.
Yeah, what a bastard. No, and elsewhere. Libby, come on, let's be serious. No. I'm just playing. We actually do have a lot of German viewers. I apologize. Please don't be triggered. It was an opportunity to make fun of Nigel Farage, who is, I mean, honestly, I mean, really is. Like, this is a good time, I think, in general, obviously, because, you know, Trump, Farage, Boris Johnson, people actually treated Bolsonaro like a joke in Brazil. There's a lot of people. There's no contradiction between being, you know, a complete jackass and a figure of correct like mockery and ridicule, and also really evil and like given power
sure,
to seriously harm people's lives. Like, there's no contradiction there.
Well, the funny thing about Farage is that, I mean, UKIP never had more than like what, 3 or 4 MPs. He lost his he ran for parliament last time and he didn't win, and you know, UKIP even after the Brexit vote has been kind of pretty sidelined. I think that's partly because of the Conservative Party, and you know, Theresa May kind of really going for the hard Brexit, you know, that hard Brexit line, but you know, this guy, like, no one, you know, he has no power, and he keeps getting invited on telly to talk about Brexit, and you know, people keep asking him what he thinks about Brexit. It's like, this man is just a posh guy in a pair of wellies now. Like, you really don't have to ask him what he thinks.
I'm sorry. What are wellies? Oh, boots.
I'm sorry.
Oh, look, no, it's all right. Matt Leck, our senior UK translator, got me. All right, they're boots.
Yeah, what like green boots.
Yeah, he looks like a penguin in them.
Yeah.
I have seen the boots. I just didn't know what they were called. Two more UK related questions, and one is also going to just be another personality that people should probably know and not like, but then a bigger question. So I saw, and people probably have a sense that a guy named, you know, David Cameron, who was another one of these, like, you know, hysterically posh and, like, you know, sort of gentry power inheritance figures in the UK. He became UK Prime Minister, I believe, in 2010. And he also, his whole first branding campaign was actually like, no, I'm like the pro environment, like I'm super hip, I'm like a different kind of Tory. And in addition to just pounding and decimating the country with austerity, which is his prime legacy, he then, as a sop to the far right and to try to suck the oxygen out of UKIP and BNP, he basically was like, yeah, let's just have a Brexit referendum, which of course he lost. And then I don't think we have it on us, but we had a lot of fun when he resigned and the hot mic caught him walking off and just after resigning, he just hummed to himself. Do you remember that? He was like, doot, doot.
Yeah, I remember that. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So I saw the other day that he was in Costa Rica renting a surfboard.
Great. That's great. I mean, honestly, I was talking to my friend about this the other night. He's really played it very smart because, like, I think he will be, even though this is all completely his fault, I think history will kind of forget him. You know, like you say, that this is all because of him. I think there was a Financial Times article at the time that revealed that he decided to do this at a pizza restaurant in Chicago O'Hare Airport. You know, just kind of on a whim, like, and like you say, to shore up, you know, his, because he thought that, you know, that would be the end of it all, and it super wasn't. But now, like you say, he's surfing in Costa Rica. Meanwhile, Theresa May is having, you know, an absolute nightmare. And, you know, believe me, I loathe Theresa May. I don't actually care that she's personally experiencing a nightmare. But, like, you know, I think she will be remembered for handling this very poorly, whereas I think David Cameron's kind of gotten away with it by resigning and just disappearing.
It's doot doot doo. All right, we got to get that back, man. That is one of the most amazing. Like, I just totally messed everything up. Doot doot doo.
My actual favorite Cameron hot mic was when they caught him on a hot mic making fun of Yorkshire, which is in the north of England, and, you know, he's from the south of England, very posh. A lot of north-south tension in the UK, and he sounds even posher when he's, like, in private than he does in public. Like,
Jesus.
In the UK, it, you know, at least for, you know, let's say in the 70s, people would pretend to be posher than they were. Like, Margaret Thatcher apparently learned how to speak with a more posh accent because, you know, she wanted to, like, fit in with all the Tories. But I think David Cameron actually toned down the posh when he's talking to the public because he's so, so posh, so elite that he just sounds ridiculous.
All right. So David Cameron and Boris Johnson, these two, and obviously as an American, I'll just throw around, it's pure speculation as I'm mindful of UK libel laws, but I would speculate potentially inbred children of unbelievable privilege. Yeah, they just did Brexit. And now another, you know, incredibly bizarre and horrific. And anybody who ever feels bad for Theresa May, just look up Windrush on Google, and any sympathy you have for her will completely evaporate. But my last question about this is, okay, I think you're totally, my sense, and obviously you know better than me, but my sense is that, yes, almost any other Labour leader, there would probably be elections happening right now because this is catastrophic and there's no credibility left in this government and you can have a snap election, right? And okay, and I support Jeremy Corbyn too. I'm not sure he's handling every part of Brexit correctly, but I also know that Brexit isn't the only thing. And I know his plans to reverse austerity and workers' cooperatives. I mean, he's providing actually some incredible ideas and speaking to the big issues of our time. And he definitely would be, you know, no doubt in my mind, a better prime minister and a very good prime minister compared to certainly, obviously, Theresa May. But just even in the normal, like, rules of politics, when you have a total failure, you make a change. And in this process of, like, total fear that all of the UK establishment, I guess, just use that word, has about Jeremy Corbyn, they're prolonging and intensifying like an actual crisis. So it's like, it's so, I guess it's like, doesn't that juxtaposition actually prove all of like Corbyn's points about this ruling class? It's like, oh, if Jeremy Corbyn's prime minister, it's going to be like Venezuela. So what we'll do is make it like what we say Venezuela is like right now, to not have this guy, to not have an election or democratic accountability. We will accelerate an actual crisis, not a hypothetical one, to not live out our fears, which we've made up in our own heads.
Right, right, exactly. No, I totally agree. And, you know, I agree that I don't think Corbyn has handled Brexit quite as well as he could have. And, I mean, it is difficult because there are a lot of issues with, you know, a lot of the kind of more Blair wing of the party want him to call for another referendum. And that is, I mean, the thing is like, I think, you know, they kind of want all this to be over and for us to go back to how it was before, which, like, I understand, because there's no way that Brexit is going to sort of benefit the UK. Like, any scenario is going to be, we're going to be worse off. Having said that, the EU is not a good institution. And I think Corbyn is kind of that old 80s left mold, you know, like really, really left, and hating the EU for that reason.
For the reasons.
For the correct reasons, exactly. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that Brexit would be good, or that, you know, that would be the best way for Britain to, you know, change the EU. So it is tricky, and I don't know, you know, because he's also in a difficult place, because if we call another referendum and we get the same result, then like what have we done then? You know, then it's like that would be even worse, and I don't know that there would be a different result. So it is tricky. But you know, I, like I said, like big Corbyn supporter. I'm 100% confident he would handle this better. But like you said, they're all completely terrified of him. I mean, if you go back and look at the way that the media reacted when Corbyn was elected party leader in 2015, it's actually remarkably similar to the way that the media reacts to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now. Yeah. You know, just any little story, any little, you know, theoretical inconsistency in his leftism, you know, there was one of the big stories was that, like, he went to some veterans event and like ate the sandwiches and he wasn't supposed to or something like that, which was amazing.
Disaster.
And there was the whole thing about like, yeah. And there was the whole thing about like not kneeling before the Queen or something and like not singing the national anthem and stuff. And, you know, this was all like mainstream papers that were reporting this. This wasn't like, you know, our version of the Daily Caller. It was like our version of, I don't know, the New York Post or even the Washington Post, you know.
Right.
It's like,
wow.
Completely balmy, like, stuff. And, you know, like, sort of just trying to make any kind of argument that he, you know, either was, you know, inappropriately, you know, un-British, or trying to catch him out, you know, being a weirdo. There was a lot of reporting on him being just, like, a weird guy, you know, like, he wears jumpers a lot and, you know, has a collection of manhole
covers. What are jumpers? Jumpers.
Sorry,
and sweaters.
Okay. Sweaters.
All right. Thank you. I'm learning.
Yeah.
Well, there was that time when he promised in, and I think it was in 2016, where he said he was going to run train on the socialist agenda. That caused
a
lot of heat.
I wish like, he had done that.
What about Urban Dictionary, Mr.
Than...
Corbyn?
Yeah. That would have been easier than her doing it. Yeah.
That would have been, I mean, it would be very hard for me to support him even more. You know, that's particularly funny because there is a parallel universe where I could hear Bernie Sanders saying that. There's none where I could hear Jeremy Corbyn saying that.
No. No, not at all.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. I mean, we'll just keep pushing for, and I mean, he should be prime minister and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And you know, I hate that it happens this way because it caused a lot of harm. But I mean, every piece of any credibility that the business, the press class, the political class had is gone. You know, think about that while they hyperventilate about this guy.
Right.
You wrote a great, I just want to take, you know, in the last like 10 minutes or so, a couple of recent pieces you wrote. Mm-hmm. You wrote this piece called The New York Times Racially Tinged Problem. I thought that was great. Can you just kind of outline it for us?
Yeah, I mean, this is a frequent problem with the New York Times, but also other outlets. Yesterday they wrote a piece about, you know, which should have been, I think, quite a good piece about sort of, you know, Republicans are condemning Steve King for racism, but why not Donald Trump, which is an interesting point. But in doing that, they did what they always do and described things Donald Trump has said as having, you know, racially tinged remarks. And it's just so frustrating because that phrase doesn't mean anything. Like, racially tinged doesn't tell you, I mean, for a start, it doesn't convey the full weight of what Donald Trump has said. I mean, I just, you know, I put the excerpt from his campaign announcement speech in there and, you know, describing Mexicans as rapists and criminals, like, right. That isn't racially tinged, that's racist. And I think the inability of the media to describe the things he says as racist is not, you know, that is important. That matters. And I think, as Adam Serwer has pointed out, that is more about preserving the feelings of a largely white audience than it is, you know, about accurately describing the situation. And it's just very frustrating to see the Times do it over and over again.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and I wonder about even like like, I think that the polling at least shows that the, at least how people answer poll questions, this sort of like, and this, you know, shows up on a lot of areas, but like a kind of like mushy middle is at least, I think, you know, in practice, there's still a lot of it, but at least polling wise, you see more like people who identify as conservative being like, essentially like, yeah, that explicitly racist sentiment expresses my thoughts. And then you see more people who identify as Democrats or whatever, who are definitely, I mean, look, white Democrats, at least in polls, they're way more willing to acknowledge, or I won't even say that because I don't necessarily think it's cynical. They're more at a point now than they were, say, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, where they're like, yes, racism is a major, you know, important force in our society and our politics. Mm-hmm. So I feel like when they write this and they use this language, it obscures the truth, sounds ridiculous, doesn't mean anything. It is kind of like goofily Orwellian. But it also, it's like, even that sort of imagined person, like, who are you talking to besides Barry Weiss? Like, literally.
Yeah, I mean, that's a general New York Times problem, because they're always writing things.
Right.
As if they have, you know, any Republican readers, and I'm sure that they have some, but Republicans aren't going to not think that the Times is biased because you say things like racially tinged. Like, and, you know, that's the other thing that was terrible about that article, that was honestly as bad, that it included a part saying that, well, you know, Democrats, you know, some Republicans say that Democrats didn't condemn the motherfucker comments, and, you know, they don't police the words they use either. And it's like, well, don't you, like, I mean, that is obviously absurd on its face. The idea that saying there are very fine people on both sides of Charlottesville is in any way equivalent to saying we're going to impeach the motherfucker. Like, that is, like, that's offensive. And if you are writing an article like that, then you have to include, you have to say, which is ridiculous. Like, I would never, even if a Republican was saying that to me, I would never quote them as saying that without saying, this is wrong.
Right. I mean, of course, obviously they could focus on Rashida Tlaib's comments where she said, you know, Arab civilization created algebra and there's nothing wrong with thinking that they're inherently superior because that's just history. That would be an equivalent if she said anything like that.
Right.
I mean that, well, and not only are you right about that, they're actually, I mean, when they repeat, the motherfucker is analogous to Steve King just being a racist or Donald Trump just being a racist. They are, not only is it's not even a ridiculous, immoral, ludicrous, false equivalency. It's just a laundering of Republican talking points, because that's what they're doing. And when you see Kevin McCarthy and people like that on TV, you know, they're not saying, and hosts are not saying, well, great, I'm glad you're stripping him of his assignments, but why did you back this guy, and why did Chuck Grassley record an ad for him a couple of weeks before he was facing re-election? They're immediately pivoting and saying, well, we wish the Democrats would do the same thing, by which they're talking about Rashida Tlaib saying MF-er. So not only, like, it's ridiculous on its face, but that's a Republican spin that has been cooked up by some Republican pollster or something. So not only are you doing a false equivalency, you're actually just laundering GOP talking points with nothing critical to say about it.
Right, exactly. And, like, this is the thing. It's, you know, in journalism, obviously, it's important to know what Republicans are saying, like, if they are saying that. But the thing is like, they're saying it to you, New York Times reporter, so that you will put it in the New York Times as if that argument has any weight. Like, they're making that argument in bad faith, and you don't have to help them by doing their PR for them. If you're going to put it in an article, then you have to do something to note that, like, that's completely insane. Like, it doesn't matter that Republicans are arguing it. Like, that doesn't make it worthy of, like, noting without any context. You know, it's like, obviously absurd on its face, and journalists have to know when they're able to say, you know, this thing that they say, which is insane, you know.
right And that's, again, and that's descriptive. That's not like that's it's not partisan. It's an ability to make some type of actual analysis here, because if not, like, then I don't know, just try to figure out the whatever AI can make Siri write New York Times articles for you or whatever, which would still probably produce more interesting work than Barry Weiss, which is a hacky joke, but I had to make it. You congratulated Raj Shah on his new lobbying position. Would you remind everybody who he is and what the new gig is?
Yeah, so he was deputy press secretary to Sarah Sanders, and now he's going to be heading up a media group doing, let's read this, bipartisan full service multidisciplinary strategic communications division, which is just, I mean, I guess that makes sense to people in DC, but whatever. But the important thing is that the group he's going to is called Ballard Partners, and Ballard Partners is run by this guy, Brian Ballard, who is an associate of Trump before he moved to D.C. Then Trump became president, and this guy took his lobbying shop from Florida to D.C. And, you know, there are a couple of articles about him last year where he kind of insisted that he was almost offended by the idea that he would trade on his access as a lobbyist. Yes, I have dinner with Trump every few weeks, but, you know, people come to me for my expertise and for my lobbying prowess, not because of my contacts, which is just obviously absurd.
No, I mean, we would never question his expertise, obviously, and I'm sure people are interested.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, haven't you? I mean, Libby, why are you so cynical when you could be doing multidisciplinary thinking with somebody?
I know. I'm really just jealous. I'm very jealous that Ballard Partners hasn't hired me to be a full service strategic communicator, I guess. But yeah, they are. I mean, this firm, you know. It really gets to the question, and I actually wrote about this at the time that he was profiled last year. It gets to the question of, like, what are lobbyists doing? Like, what do they do all day? Right. You know, obviously, I mean, there are some lobbying firms that get hired, you know, companies retain them to, you know, some of the work they do is kind of like, you know, research and, like, informing members of Congress. And literally what they will do is, like, create research packets for congressional staff, which are all underpaid and overworked. And then, you know, the information they get is from lobbyists, and, you know, because they don't have time to assemble it themselves, they'll just use whatever, you know, Ballard Partners or whoever sent over. But, you know, it's obvious that the reason that this firm is doing so well with, you know, many millions of dollars in income a year is because of the closeness to Trump. I mean, Amazon, for example, already has 15 other lobbying firms on retainer. So why would they pay a 16th firm, Ballard Partners, you know, over $200,000 in 2018 to lobby? And it's clear that, you know, that's a connection to Trump that is worth a couple hundred grand to them. You know, that's just like one other avenue to Trump or whoever in that White House that is worth 200 grand to be able to access.
Yeah, and this is the type of Trump era story where it's like, this definitely, like, there's things that are obviously weird and unusual and very different about Trump. But there's a lot of other things where it's just like an amplification of what already is. And this type of dynamic is totally bipartisan and basically across the board in D.C. I like, though, the Amazon part of it, though, because it's like, this is another good thing to remind people of. It's like, okay, like Trump is beefing with Jeff Bezos on Twitter, and the Washington Post publishes all sorts of reporting that Trump doesn't like, some of which is, you know, good reporting. But the other dynamic that's much more reflective of reality is that Amazon, as a rapacious, you know, monopolistic company, which hires all sorts of influence peddling firms to do all sorts of work, both nationally and locally, is paying off some, you know, some actually pretty marginal firm before Trump to get access to him. And that's like the bigger truth than, you know, whatever Trump's like freaking out about on Twitter about Jeff Bezos getting divorced or whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, 100%. It's really frustrating to see people like, reflexively side with Jeff Bezos against Trump as if you have to pick one. Yes. And as if Jeff Bezos is anything but, you know, just like Lex Luthor. Like, he's one of the worst people in the world and is the richest person in the world. So no good.
He's on both lists, and there's so much overlap in that list. It's actually that's a worst person and richest person lists are very cross-pollinating. Libby Watson, I really appreciate your time. I hope we can do this again. Read all of Libby's work at Splinter and follow her on Twitter and everywhere else you follow people. Libby, thanks so much for doing this.
Of course. Thank you. Happy to be here.
You too. Take care. All right, folks. I learned two new British words. What were they again?
Was it jumper? And
wellies.
Wellies.
You wear wellies to Glastonbury.
You wear wellies to Glastonbury.
They're okay. Like those big rain boots that you pull up to your knees.
I knew exactly. No, because I've noticed, because I've seen pictures of Farage. I knew what you were talking about as soon as you guys explained it to me. I just had no idea. Yeah, he is some like Thatcherite multimillionaire asshole. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. Join the show for pennies a day. Get your coffee, fair trade tea, coffee, chocolate at the great co-op, justcoffee.coop. It's real fair trade stuff. Everybody, even Starbucks tried to co-opt that brand, but Just Coffee actually does it. They're our friends. They support the show. And they provide great, actual pro-labor, pro-ecology, pro-worker cooperative products, which are delicious. That's the coffee we drink. It's the coffee that powers the Majority Report ship. Get your tickets to the Michael Brooks Show live show February 1st. We're excited to see you there. This Sunday, David Adler, he's on the governing body of DiEM25, which is the pan-socialist effort across Europe. We're talking about migration, left nationalism, and critiquing it using Marx. You got to become a patron of TMBS to get all of that and countless other pieces of historical, theoretical, global content, plus the very fun, very entertaining. On this last post game, we dunked on Jimmy Dore. We talked about Buju Banton, right-wing Mandela Gavin McGinnis. Patreon.com/TMBS. Subscribe to Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and tell those motherfuckers to monetize us. Got to figure that out. That's actually really quite weird. Matt was pointing out the other day how there's still people selling like fake cancer cures that are monetized on YouTube.
Actually, like verified, which and Majority verified? Report isn't even verified on YouTube.
Wow. Well, that says a lot.
But you can apparently cure pretty late stage cancer with baking soda, according to YouTube.
Right.
Things that they'll monetize. So.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to put an ad into a smart Brexit analysis or a video on the political imprisonment of Lula. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, and of course on iTunes and so on, and see you at the live show. Matt.
Literary Hangover. Literary Hangover coming this weekend. Hopefully I'll get it up by Saturday. We're recording tonight, The House of the Seven Gables, which is probably, I think, the most interesting thing I've read by Hawthorne. Maybe the most interesting thing I've read for this entire project. A lot of interesting inheritance stuff going on about stuff about politics and corruption. Very interesting stuff.
Very interesting. Patreon.com/literary hangover.
Correct.
Check out The Antifada, Jamie and Sean. In the spirit as well, that's The Antifada on Patreon. Patreon.com/The Antifada. In the spirit of the opening of the show, we were talking about dopes who won't debate Sam. Here is a brilliant video that Brian McAllister did about one of those dopes that won't debate Sam. It's going to take you into the fun half where we will see you there.
And I do like to think that, I mean, it's really hard to get leftist guests on our show. That's just a reality. We try and book them.
Crowder doesn't think there's a rape culture.
I usually do try and get into an engagement of ideas.
Steven Crowder, so interesting.
You know, now that we're talking about Steven Crowder, 3 or 4 months ago, I was invited to Politicon. When they asked me if I would come, I said, yeah, I will, if I can debate someone. Now, of course, I threw out Dave Rubin, and I was told that he's not coming.
Competition would start kicking in.
And so I said Crowder, and the people were like, great, and it all looked good. And I was told that Steven Crowder literally stopped responding to their emails.
Emails.
Pretty sure the quote was, somebody got cold feet. Steven Crowder, I am issuing you a challenge to debate. I will host you on any time, any platform, any way to debate. Really, the question that Steven Crowder should ask his Alexa is, do I have the fortitude to debate Sam Seder?
No, you are not courageous enough to face a middle-aged Jew who likes facts and figures. You are a coward.
Steven, I know you are watching or hearing this, and everybody else knows it too. There's no way you're not aware that I've issued this challenge now. You knew it was coming when you backed out of Politicon because you were afraid of debating me, and here it is. Steven, we'll see you soon.
Maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but you can wear your not gay t-shirt, and you can have an opening statement, right? You'll let him have the opening statement, I'm assuming.
Oh, sure.